Let's see. I guess that's a pretty good cart view, huh? I have to turn the. Oops! Always a lot of cords. Okay. Greetings to everyone. I will greet the people on Zoom first, and then in this room, people can say their own name and we'll repeat it. Susan, are you in like a mansion? Or is that a fake background?
It's beautiful.
Yeah, something like that, except it's virtual, but
Oh,
it's close.
dang, Susan. Hello, Susan. Ellen. Mick. Karen. Linda R. Bob. Jim. Jeff. Shoketsu. Chris. Jinryu. John. Joan, Alice, Phil, Tracy, Paulette, Drew, Albert, Sabrina, and Ruth Ann, and in the Zendo, Mark, Warren, Dave, Erica. Coral, Carson. Those of you in the Zendo, are you going to be able to hear me? Okay, because we do have, I just haven't gotten the habit of turning on the amplifying speaker, so be sure to let me know if anybody needs that. Okay. So let's see. Announcements. We have a one day retreat coming up on Saturday, January 29th, and you can participate in person or online, part time or full time. So I've already gotten a bunch of registrations for that, so it should be sweet. It's a lovely way to spend a day, and it's a very reasonable schedule. Because you can like have breakfast, come to the retreat, you bring your lunch or you have lunch as part of the retreat, and then wraps up before dinner. So it's a good day, except for those of you, sorry, Mick, who are in a completely different time zone. So I don't know how you work it. Let's see, and then the. Calendar on the website has been is getting filled in more fully for what we're going to do over the next year, including the term student program, which the opening retreat is February 26th, the Saturday, and closing is May 14th, also a Saturday. And there's 2 one-day retreats in between. And there's information that will be coming out in the newsletter about that. That's, you commit to the term with the opening retreat and closing retreat. And make some vows of practice. And the people who've signed up for that, get to know one another and support one another in their vows over the course of the term. Yeah, and Jukai, June 5th, a Sunday, and there will be 10 weeks of precept classes before that, and those are on the calendar now. We study the precepts every year. So I think that's all I have to say, except that I just, in terms of COVID, we are going ahead as we are for now. I figure if we get to the point that our local hospitals are begging us to stay home, maybe we will pause meeting for a while, but you know, we're all vaccinated who are coming in person. We shouldn't be too much of a burden on the healthcare system, even if we do get sick. I'm taking my mask off for the talk, but I do have a bunch of, I got a whole bunch of antigen tests in December before there was a run on them. So I am testing myself on Tuesdays and Sundays before I come. So yeah, trying to play it safe, but also keep meeting. Any questions or other things that I should announce? Right. Sounds good. So tonight we're continuing with our discussion of this book by Kjøgen Carlsen. You are still here, one of my teachers. And tonight we're discussing two chapters, chapters 13 and 14. So chapter 13 is on Kensho, which if you read it ahead of time and you have questions, I invite you to bring them up at some point tonight. And then the second chapter is on sudden and gradual realization or awakening. So it's a good chapter to put the Kensho chapter into some perspective. So Kensho means seeing the true nature, or seeing the nature, implying seeing the true nature. And it's often said the seeing the true nature of self. Because for us, for human beings, understanding the true nature of ourself is like kind of the first step. Our nature is the same as the nature of everything else, but we're particularly concerned about ourselves. So seeing into the true nature of ourself is this pivotal insight that we are hoping for. Now, we don't talk a lot about Kensho, about, or AKA Satori, or about enlightenment per se, not in this tradition. And I'm going to be talking more about why. On the other hand, it's kind of everywhere. A Buddha means an awakened being. So a sentient being who has awakened to what, right? But they're enlightened, they are liberated because of the insight that they have. So seeing clearly, realization, clarity, insight, is understood in Buddhism and Zen to be essential and transformative and liberative. And the basic premise is that our suffering is caused by delusion, a lack of understanding and clarity about the true nature of self and reality. That fundamentally, all beings just want to avoid suffering and be happy. But we're obviously not that good at this. And the reason is because there's ways we think these things are going to result in happiness, or we think these things will let us avoid suffering, but they actually don't, or we're deluded about the results that we get. So I wanted to start off with, so I'm going to be covering, you know, kind of summarizing what Kjøgen talks about and elaborating on it. But I wanted to explore first to really ask you, do you want to awaken? What do you think that means? What do you think the experience would be like? How do you think it would change you? Now I'm imagining there's a lot of variation amongst all of you. Are you going for what I like to say, the big E? Are you going, you know, is there part of you, even if you might not say it publicly, who really does want, you know, enlightenment? Maybe not like what a Buddha has, but you know, that key insight, radically different view. Or are you just hoping for little insights? And this is fine. But does any part of you envy, think about, feel awed by the prospect of a deeply transformative insight? Even if you think it might be something that really is just going to happen to other people, not to you. So I want this, as much as possible, this discussion about Kensho, enlightenment, awakening, sudden and gradual, to be a relevant and personal conversation, not an abstract one. You know, what the, in theory, what enlightenment is and how what the Buddha might have experienced and blah, blah, blah. So that I'm going to have us go into group, small groups for 10 minutes. So in the Zendo, we can go into two groups of three, and we can go into breakout groups. And just to talk freely about what you think enlightenment or awakening is in the Buddhist sense. And as much as possible, try not to worry about whether you have the right answer. Just be honest. I don't know, I have this sense that it's this thing, or I heard that it's this thing, or my impression is that it's this, or my limited experience tells me that it's this. And maybe you have ideas about it that you suspect are wrong, or incomplete, or whatever. So what? Let's just start there. So this is a big, elusive concept. So, you know, it definitely, you're not going to walk away from tonight going, ah, okay, I know what enlightenment and awakening is now. it's big. So it's valuable just to wrestle with it, not to necessarily, you know, conclude that you've got it all wrapped up or be right about it. And if you're absolutely new to Buddhism and Zen, do you have any impressions about how Buddhist and, you know, enlightenment is conceived in our culture? Most people in our culture now really know nothing about Buddhism, Zen, anything, but they, some vague, you know, they saw a little Buddha, or, you know, they've seen a Buddha statue or whatever. So they've usually heard the word enlightenment. So they might have some idea, you know, they know who the Dalai Lama is. So they might have some idea about what that means. So what do you think enlightenment or awakening, if you prefer that term, whichever term you like, really is? Do you think it's something real? Something you could experience for yourself, at least in theory? Is it something people attain? What is the advantage of awakening? What is an awakened person like? So choose someone to, so the first thing, try to choose someone to report back to the bigger group. But don't worry about, you know, telling us everything that you said. Just, you know, whoever's going to report back, just think, you know, one or two things that is kind of interesting that you might want to make note of, and especially if it doesn't get mentioned by other groups. And if for some reason, you know, if you're online and you don't want to participate in a breakout room, you don't have to accept the invitation, but I hope you will, even if you mostly just want to listen. Okay. So 10 minutes.
Here we go.
And then why don't Coral and Carson, you break up this time. And yeah, go ahead and like space yourselves out a little bit. So. Let's see, an interesting point or two from each group, perhaps. Anybody want to volunteer first?
I can go first for,
Okay, go ahead, Tracy.
yeah, so some of the big pieces that came through from ours is many little subtle awakenings, deep wisdom, acting like a long-term practitioner, ordinary and mundane, and then I'm experiencing the self dropping off.
Thank you. I think I saw Joan.
A big one was not being bothered about what other people thought about you. Just being able to not have that be an issue. Not worrying about approval, and I guess go in going in hand with that would be not judging other people. And towards the end, one that came up was less me and more of everything else. So, and gratitude, I guess, is part of that. So, yeah, that's pretty simple.
Thank you.
Are you interested in the big E? Our group had one yes, one no, and one maybe. One of us thought that enlightenment was smaller than we make it out to be, that it's little things like walking along without being distracted. One of us was worried about, paraphrasing, worried about becoming attached to it, about feeling like you were finished when they weren't interested in feeling like they were finished. One of us thought that it would be beautiful to have a moment where all of the old doctrines and dogmas simply became descriptions of the way things are.
Mick.
Yeah, our group talked a lot about enlightenment, sort of like in terms of the way that we relate to other people and accepting other people for who they are, and kind of like having that relationships that are kind of free from like expectations, I guess. And we also talked a lot about like letting go of things, like attachment to stuff and that kind of stuff. That's mostly what we hit on. And we also talked, it's weird, this notion of enlightenment as like, do you want it? Because fundamentally, that sounds like A, it's something that is somewhere that you like go to and then get. And it's also weird because that seems like grasping, like you don't like, so it's an interesting thing. So we talked a lot about it as in terms of like maybe like a less of a thing and more of like a path, I guess. So it was we had a pretty good discussion.
And Jeff.
Our group considered your question, Domio, about whether we wanted to achieve enlightenment, and there was some pretty broad interest in that. And then one person experienced that as something they might be reluctant to experience, especially if it meant giving up things or things you didn't anticipate needing to be given up, perhaps. One person shared that they were very found very helpful Kyogen's comment about the eternal now and that potentially being an element of enlightenment. We spoke about the idea that it might be achieved in small steps as opposed to one giant leap. And then we talked about the idea that enlightenment might be something like awakening from a trance of delusion or misperception. Thank you.
Let's see, and who's spokesperson for the other group? Ah, Carson.
So we talked about how I think enlightenment is just living without delusion, you know, dispel that delusion and seeing the world in reality for what it is and living in that reality instead of a deluded world or reality. And we talked a little bit about what we remember thinking enlightenment was before we started practicing or studying. I remember thinking it used to be, I used to think it was something very profound and almost unimaginable and unattainable and transcending reality. And now we think it's a lot more along the lines of something that's a little more mundane and simple, but still the unattainable or impossible is attached to it.
Anybody else online? All right. Oh, Alice.
Let's see. Some words that were spoken was someone who's really in the present, open for anything, non-judgmental, not polluted by thoughts or story of past and present. And then it could come in as a big thunderclap, or it could come in as small gradual blooming of a flower. And then I brought up a conspiracy theory that we're all enlightened all the time. We just don't know it. Like when your baby wakes up and starts crying and you hold it, or when you're working on a spreadsheet at work, or when you're playing football and you're ready for the ball. So that's my theory. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Shall we move on? Thank you everyone for wrestling with that topic. So one of the things that I think, one of the ways to phrase our practice for me is increasing our tolerance for ambiguity. So increasing our ability to hold apparent paradox, because that's just the way life is, and to not having to, like, you know, defend ourselves or conceptualize or something, but just living with the ambiguity of life. So one ambiguity you will encounter in Zen is that the experience of awakening is emphasized, even though we don't talk about it a lot. In other forms of Buddhism, some kind of attainment or experience or verifiable insight is much emphasized. In Theravadan Buddhism, it's understood to be much more gradual. It's understood you work very hard at your meditative practice and you learn how to concentrate and you learn, then you do insight meditation and you build insight, and so you approach what the Buddha realized in that way. In other forms like Vajrayana, you know, there are other ways that you attain this kind of insight. And in Rinzai Zen, there is, generally speaking, much more emphasis on awakening experiences. When you go to a retreat, it's like, all right, people, let's get to work. And, you know, you sit there and you are encouraged to, you know, die on the cushion and, you know, and like, it's right here. Can't you see it? Wake up, you know, and it's very different. It's very different than what we do, which is Soto Zen to begin with, and also very, very lay-oriented Soto Zen. So we want our practice to be very, very inviting and accessible. Like I've talked about before, we use the Dharma rain model, right? So the Dharma falls equally on all beings. They take up what they want. So there might be some people out there who are like, you know, gunning for Kensho, and other people who are like, I just want to follow the precepts and reduce the stress in my life a little bit. And we say that is fine. So we don't want to overemphasize awakening experiences and thereby give anybody the impression that their practice is illegitimate or whatever. However, it's still there. And, you know, an example of it is, you know, here it is. It's a chapter in Kyogen's book. So our attitude toward it, to some extent, some of you will be familiar with this, the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, a compilation of talks by Shinryu Suzuki Roshi. So it has a preface by Houston Smith. And he's talking about, he starts off saying two Suzukis. So D.T. Suzuki is another Zen guy who brought Zen to the West through his books and writings and teachings. But that's not the same as Shunryu Suzuki. D.T. Suzuki was a Rinzai guy. So Houston Smith is saying, two Suzukis. A half century ago, in a transplant that has been likened in its historical importance to the Latin translations of Aristotle in the 13th century and of Plato in the 15th, Daisetsu Suzuki brought Zen to the West single-handed. 50 years later, Shunryu Suzuki did something almost as important. He sounded exactly the follow-up note Americans interested in Zen needed to hear. Whereas Daisetsu Suzuki's Zen was dramatic, Shunryu Suzuki's is ordinary. Satori, another word for Kensho, or this, you know, pivotal insight, was focal for Daisetsu, and it was in large part the fascination of this extraordinary state that made his writings so compelling. In Shunryu Suzuki's book, the words Satori and Kensho, its near equivalent, never appear. When 4 months before his death, I had the opportunity to ask him why Satori didn't figure in his book, his wife leaned toward me and whispered impishly, "It's because he hasn't had it." Whereupon the Roshi batted his fan at her in mock consternation, and with a finger to his lips hissed, "Shh, don't tell him." When our laughter had subsided, he said simply, "It's not that Satori is unimportant, but it's not the part of Zen that needs to be stressed." So this is the kind of the Soto Rinzai complementary dichotomy. If we overemphasize awakening experiences, as it says in our reading by Hunger, aggressiveness appears. If we emphasize the illumination part, then you start to, like people were saying, you conceive of it as something separate from you, something you're gonna get. Do you have it? I got it before you. It's comparison. It brings out the worst in us in some ways. But if you go all the way over to the other side and you say, you know, it's just about our everyday life, it's just about becoming a nicer person, then there can be a little danger of complacency. So what Hungzhe says is murkiness leads to wasted dharma. So we're trying to kind of hold both of these, not get too excited and freaked out about this, but also not completely dismiss. So you might want to ignore this teaching entirely and just focus on your daily practice, and that is fine. But I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about what Kyogen shares in his chapter. So he talks about this, what it is that we're awakening to as being sarvajnata, all knowledge. So he takes that from a story of the Buddha. And he says, sarvajnata is an interesting term. It's page 76. It means all knowledge or omniscience. But in the Buddhist sense, it's not about information. When we see clearly into the nature of each thing we meet, we function as sarvajnata. It is not something that is attained by oneself, but something that exists in a collective way. We serve it rather than obtain it. So Kyogen talks about a koan story that really inspired him in his practice. And that is the story of the nun Chiyono. So he talks about this on page 77. Who has she practiced a long time and did not get it, you know, whatever it is, right? And if you are in a community of practitioners, eventually someone else in that community is going to be acknowledged as having, whether they got it, like people are saying, in a flash, or they got it gradually, they got something, they understand something. And then you go, hey, wait a minute. What is that? What did you get? So here's the nun Chiyono, and she's practiced a long time. And presumably, there are other people around her who have gotten it. And she's trying, and she's meditating, and she's studying. So it says, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlit night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail. And at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. So Kyogen talked about how important this koan was for him, because the binding the bamboo pail is like, this is the effort we make. The effort we make in our meditation, and the effort we make following precepts, and, you know, working on our relationships and trying to understand. So we're binding this pail. And then Kyogen also talks about how after a while at the monastery, he realized he needed to keep on working on putting more and more of himself in the bucket, if you will. And when he first got to the monastery, he thought, oh, right. And he dedicated himself. But then he realized, like he said, he felt like he was only wet up to his ankles. And after another year of striving, he was only wet up to his knees. It's like only over time do we recognize what we're actually holding back and what more we can put into the bucket. So he describes this point at which he feels like he's put everything into the bucket and still nothing. And he was frustrated by the fact that Roshi Kennett, his teacher at Shasta, she emphasized Kensho a lot. And she was apparently pretty good at guiding people toward it. But she would say that a student needed to reach bottom before this happened. They had to reach this point of just, you know, beating your head against a wall, desperation, you've put it all out there. And this really frustrated Kyogen because he's like, I'm making improvements in my practice. I'm growing and I'm learning. How can I, you can't just manufacture hitting the bottom, right? But then he describes his Kensho experience. So he had, as on page 82, he had spent a day. So this is down at Shasta Abbey, which is in Northern California, you know, the volcanic cones all over. So they go and they climb Black Butte, which is near the abbey. And then they were going to look down off the butte and take photographs of the abbey from above. So he takes this, you know, arduous, exhausting, you know, you're climbing up this volcanic shale, I'm sure it's dirty, and he says he's got boots that are too big, he's got blisters, they get to the top, they realize there was an easy path that led up the other side, and it, you know, it's just a crappy day, and they go back down the trail, and then they end up, you know, way too far from the monastery, they don't get back till after dinner, so he sleeps in the next morning, which is, you know, it's okay to sleep in if you've had a really, really rough day. But then he comes into the refectory where he's going to eat the next morning. And then he hears Roshi Kennett say something about another monk who, like, despite all the stuff he had to do the day before, he was in the Zendo this morning. And Kyogen just like, yeah, this is too much. She said, there's a monk who really wants the practice. Kyogen thought, ah, shit, my veins are open and I'm giving everything I've got to this place and this practice. I miss one lousy sitting period and she praises this person who turned up this morning. Well, pfft. I'm not sure what happened next. I think I may have started to cry. I thought, what the hell is the point? Roshi asked me, well, what is it? I said, there's no love here. I meant that I felt completely unseen. She got up and walked across the room and looked deep into my eyes and said, and walked away. About then, breakfast arrived. The other monks hadn't made it down yet. It was just her and me and one other monk in the refectory. I was sitting there looking at my plate. She said, Kyogen, look up. I thought, yeah, right. I've heard that before. She said, no, I mean it. Look up. I kind of sat up, but I was still looking down at my plate. To me, what she meant was, look on the bright side. Be cheerful. Be a good little monk, and everything will be, and look at everything with a bright, shiny face. I thought, oh, pfft. But I sat up. She said, no, I mean it. Put your hands palm up and look up. She came around behind me and took my hands and turned them over. I looked up, and boom, I was just flooded with a release and affirmation. I won't try to describe all the stuff that happened, but I ended up under the table, laughing my fool head off. So that was Kyogen's Kensho. And in Zen, we understand that Kensho is just the beginning. It's not an enlightenment experience, which, you know, is like the equivalent of Shakyamuni Buddhas, and therefore you're omniscient and all-knowing and have no more work to do. But it's understood to be like a pivotal moment. After that, the insights are clarifications. The insights are deepening. This is a shift of a transformational shift of perspective. So what did Kyogen see? And I've known other people who've had, I haven't witnessed them in person, but apparently had these kinds of dramatic experiences. I have not. I am, as the second chapter talks about, I'm one of the you know, get wet in the mist kind of people. But Kyogen says in that second chapter, Sudden and Gradual, that he has witnessed people who had dramatic openings and people who have, you know, the flowers open slowly, and they come to the same place. So I can't say exactly what Kyogen's experience was that day, of course. But here's my best effort at describing what we can awaken to. And so much of what people were talking about, because I asked, you know, what is an awakened person like and stuff, a lot of times these things, these less self, this, you know, more intimate with life, this less caring about what people think, this is a result of this insight. If we're lucky. I mean, we do have to integrate it. It's not a magic thing, but. So for some reason, you momentarily let go of a view you are holding, an all-pervasive frame through which you usually perceive and relate to everything. And this view is so pervasive, so all-encompassing, you don't even realize it's a view. It formed throughout your childhood. It has been with you. It's to you, it just seems like reality. This is the way things are, the way I am, the way the world is, how things work. But through the efforts of practice, you're able to question that view. Open to the possibility it's just a view. Experience reality without that view. It's waking up to reality, one that has been covered in a fog of your self-centered dream. The reality you see seems remarkable and luminous, complete, lacking nothing. Just as it is. And none of the usual reasons for inadequacy or angst or dissatisfaction get in the way of this completeness. They remain as facts, but it's almost like they're just irrelevant. They don't obstruct this aspect of reality you are perceiving. Even the fog of the self-centered dream is just part of phenomena. And at the same time, reality perceived free of your mental map, as I like to say sometimes, is surprisingly familiar. So like Carson was saying, it's not this like, whoa, transcendent, trippy, it's you're seeing what you were seeing before, but in a different way. And you recognize you've always been surrounded by this, informed by it, intimate with it. It's not a reality populated by different beings and forms with different rules. It's simply reality that always has been and always will be, for once experienced free from the dream of self. So this is one of the, I don't know if it's a helpful metaphor or not, but this is like being caught up in your life, drama, your roles, your relationships, your circumstances, your job, injustices, pleasures, all the things of the world. And, you know, within that context, maybe you practice, you become more skillful at things. And then one day, you notice a door. And you walk out the door into the almost blinding daylight. And realize your whole life has been part of a play, acted out in a theater. Like, imagine your change in perspective. What? Wait, what? Like, you look back at the stage and all the like, oh my God, what's happening? What? It's just a play? But this is where the metaphor breaks down. because our life is to be part of that play. Our life is to go back and rejoin the play. We need to go back to it, participate in wholeheartedly, take our role. But once, honestly, you have a larger perspective, this can actually be tough. But once we are participating again, we can have a different relationship to all of it. There's a way it can feel kind of, you know, at our good moments, not at all moments, it can feel more optional. It can feel more like, well, that's interesting. Let's see what happens next. Huh, that's a twist in the plot. We're not, it's, our perspective on it is completely different. So the good thing about dramatic experiences is that they are strong evidence that there is something to awaken to. So they're good in that sense, even though they also cause a lot of problems. Because then you have to integrate it. And so, as Kyoken says in the next chapter, sometimes the sudden experience is actually, in his observation, I'm not an expert on it, but his observation was oftentimes people who had that kind of experience actually had a lot of blocks. They actually had a lot of, you know, trauma or blocks or whatever. So then it was like, you know, it's more of a sudden transformation. Whereas I feel like I've always been very fortunate. Great mental health, very rooted in reality. And my mind would basically just like, let me see this much and go, all right, that's enough. That was okay. Okay, let's just go integrate that now. We don't want to look at too much and get too freaked out, right? But, you know, so even though that's kind of frustrating and not as dramatic, it, you know, it gets you to the same place. And at some point, I know I've said this before, but I still, even long into practice, there was still part of me, especially when I went to these retreats, right, where I'm like, Todd, you know, maybe I do need to have that experience. Maybe there's that something I'm missing that I need to have this experience that makes me like fall off my meditation cushion. But it wasn't happening. And at a certain point, I asked myself, why do I want that? Because I wasn't dissatisfied with my practice, per se. It's like, why do I want that? And I realized why I wanted it was because then I would have no doubt. If I just, you know, wham, bang, like Kyogen, I ended up under the table laughing my head off. I'd be like, there it was. See, that was real. But then I realized I didn't actually have doubt anymore. Not of that kind. So I didn't need to have a big, you know, dramatic experience in order to be satisfied. So I'm sorry I took us all the way up till 9 and we don't have any more chances for questions. But hopefully that was helpful. Interesting. And if you do have questions, try to remember them and save them up, and maybe we can start off with them next week. So I will say, dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Parajna Paramita. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Thank you, Damio.
Thank you.